Coming up next on WNJC, an hour of gold with Carol Gold. Call in live at 856-227-1360 and share your thoughts on all the challenges you are facing in a rapidly changing world. I'm Carol Gold. You're listening to WNJC 1360 AM, and this is An Hour of Gold.
Good morning, everyone. It's a beautiful, sunny day here in southern New Jersey. And while we're challenged around the world with lots of issues that we can talk about here today, we can also take a moment and enjoy this magnificent weather that we've been gifted with. The number here is 856-227-1360. Please feel free to call in this morning to discuss any of what I'm about to talk about, but also anything that's of interest to you, because ultimately, An Hour of Gold is your show as well as mine. Everything that's of interest to you is of interest to me, because the basic premise here is that there's only one of us. And so we tend to all experience very similar things with slight variations, but ultimately it's our humanity that brings us together, and that's what we do here at An Hour of Gold. In fact, the basic premise of the show is to find the positive message and the highest truth that's available for us in any story, whether it's global, national, local, or even personal. And so this morning, I want to start with what is essentially a personal story, although a very public one. And it's about my show last week. Last week, the first half hour of my show felt very sort of scattered and disjointed to me. It didn't feel right when I was on air. And when the show ended, at the end of the hour, my personal assistant and the person working the board here said, you know, you were kind of off in the first half hour. It wasn't really like you. And it gave me pause for thought, and I spent the next couple of days thinking about the fact that not only did I not feel right when I was on air, but it also didn't come across right, and that was the feedback that I got. And I wanted to understand that, because as I said, my show isn't just about finding the positive message and finding the highest good or the highest truth and everything, but I try to live that way as well. I don't come on here and espouse or talk about anything that I don't try to live every day in my life. And after I thought about it, I realized what had gone wrong with the first half hour of the show. And what went wrong was that I wasn't true to myself. I wasn't being my authentic self. And the reason that I wasn't doing that was because I had prepared for that show, and as I always do, I look at world events and I look at the news and I try to decide, you know, what stories are important and where can we find, even from the darkest stories, the positive message. And I had spent a lot of prep time in that first half hour on some political issues and some global issues. But the point is, I got really caught up in the news. I got really caught up in what you can listen to on any other station that you like, whether it's on radio or TV or through the internet. I was covering the same stuff in a way, with the same perspective, with a little bit of twist and a little bit of positivity to it. But you know what? You don't need to tune in here on Tuesday mornings between 10 and 11 to hear what you can hear somewhere else. That's not why I'm here. I'm here so you can tune in and hear something you can't hear anywhere else. And what you can't hear anywhere else is what I do best. And what I do best is inspiration, hope, and a positive approach to life, no matter what's going on around us. And so I realized that I had violated my own basic law, which is authenticity. And so An Hour of Gold is about was created to be about and will be about from this point on. Only those messages, only those experiences that I have or that I observe around me in the world or that you call in with, that you're experiencing, that surpass the superficial news that we get every day and go to a deeper level of our humanity. And I say that because we've spent a very long time, probably a couple thousand years, solidifying our differences. And there's nothing wrong with being unique. Each one of us is an individual. Each one of us comes with our own unique set of contributions and challenges into this world. And I would never say that anyone should give up their individuality. But if you take individuality out of context, then we each become separate and detached beings that have no connection to one another, because everything in the extreme is dangerous, including individuality. Because individuality has to be understood within the context of our humanity, in the context of our connectedness to one another, and in the context that without the other, we don't exist. And here's what I mean by that. And I went over this a little bit last week in the show. I think it might have been the second half hour when I wasn't being so inauthentic, but I'm going to go over it again because it really is key to everything that I talk about here and everything that I think is helpful for us to get through the kinds of transition that we're going through in life now. And it's the difference between basically two different philosophers. One is Aristotle and one is Nagarjuna. Nagarjuna was an Indian, actually a Buddhist. He was born an Indian but became a Buddhist. And he lived about 150, maybe between 150 and 200 in the common era. And Aristotle lived about 350 BC. So they were what? They were 400 or 500 years apart. But here's the thing. Aristotle and Aristotle's findings and philosophies are what founded the West. It's what the West has built itself upon. Aristotle believed in duality. He believed in this or that. He believed in X or not X. Something either was or it was not that thing. There were only two options. And from that Greek philosopher came down through thousands of years the reality that we live in, or that we have lived in for a very long time, which is that something either is one thing or it's the other. It's black or it's white. It's up or it's down. It's left or it's white. It's left or it's right. It's us or them. And it's a false premise, because whether it's quantum physics that you look at, so you're looking at it through a scientific lens, or whether you look at it through Nagarjuna, the Buddhist philosopher's perspective, which I'll explain in a moment, things are not black and white. We have come to learn through scientific confirmation of a 2,000-year-old philosophical belief that everything is relative. And what does that mean? So for the moment, let's look at Nagarjuna. Instead of everything being X or not X, Nagarjuna said there are four possible scenarios, and they're called lemmas. And the reason they're called lemmas is because a lemma is a proposition. So when you're in a dilemma, when you have a dilemma and you're stuck between two choices, you're in Aristotelian thought. You're in this or that. A dilemma is a tension that exists between two things, X or not X. That's why we say I have a dilemma. A dilemma is when you're usually caught between two thoughts and you don't know which way to go. Well, a tetralemma is based on four possibilities, and they are this: X or not X. So that's two. That's the first one, X or not X. They're your first two. That's Aristotle's dilemma. But then Nagarjuna said, you can then have X and not X, so you could have both. So you could have one or the other or both, or ultimately you could have one or the other or both or neither. So neither X nor not X. So it's a little complicated. Let me go back. It's actually quite simple, but when you hear it for the first time, Aristotelian logic is X or not X. They're your only two choices. That's your dilemma. That's what you struggle with in most of your life. Do I pick this or that? Do I go this way or that way? Do I marry this person or do I marry that person? Do I take this job or do I take that job? Do I wear this dress or that dress? Do I play golf or do I play tennis? That's the world we live in, okay? Now, your option is, do I do X or do I not do X? Maybe I'll do both. Maybe I'll do neither. A whole other world of possibilities opens up for you when we think beyond duality. That's a tetralemma. And science has come to prove that that's not just philosophical mental meanderings. That's quantum physics. We know that everything is relative. Einstein taught us that everything is relative. So is mass and space, mass and location. You cannot have location without mass, and you cannot define mass without location. That's what relativity has proven. So what does that mean? That means that when you can only identify location by measuring it against something. So we talk about a distance being in relation to a fixed point. You need mass in order to determine location. But you also need location in order to determine mass, because something exists within an area. That mass exists within an area. It has its identity in relationship to the location. So everything in the quantum level we've learned is relative. Everything is relative to something else. So out of everything else, something arises. It's called co-arising, which means that nothing is really independent of anything else. Everything requires let's call it a reference point. Everything requires a reference point of sorts, including we human beings. And our reference point is one another. So without the other, you don't exist, because it's in relationship to the other that you exist. So if we don't exist without a reference point, and our reference point is each other, then we need each other to affirm our very existence. It doesn't mean we give up our individuality. It means we understand each other, we understand ourselves within the context of a whole, okay, of something that is whole, ultimately whole. And that's what happened to me last week. Everything you just heard is what I've been chewing on since I was here last week with you, because it didn't feel right. And it didn't feel right because, again, I was not my authentic self. Now, why was I not my authentic self? Why did I get pulled off my game? Why did I think I had to be on radio and I had to deliver it a certain way? Where did that come from? Well, I'll tell you about that in a moment after I break to talk about my favorite Italian restaurant, Stefano's Italian Ristorante and Catering, located in Mount Laurel. I love good food. I love good Italian food. But in a faltering economy, in an economy that's as tricky as the one we're in, the last thing I want to do, and probably the last thing you want to do, is go out to eat and not get a good meal, or go out to eat and feel that you didn't get good value for your money. And that's why Stefano's is the answer to both of those issues. Stefano's has been in Mount Laurel for 26 years, and it is great value and delicious taste. What more could you want? Well, I'll tell you. You also get a delightful atmosphere and a warm, caring, committed owner. Paola Bassamo has been there from inception. It's her restaurant. It's her baby, although she's got actually three of her own real children. It's her baby, and every ounce of her caring and concern and commitment and love is in the food, and it's in the restaurant. So please, if you're going out to eat and you want a good meal and you want good value, make sure you stop at Stefano's Italian Catering and Ristorante. She caters corporate, Which is a whole other aspect of the business. If you're in the area and you have a business and you want to bring in lunches, this is where you want to bring them in from. Stefano's Italian Ristorante and Catering in Mount Laurel. Mention An Hour of Gold, and in addition to the good food, great atmosphere, and great value, you'll get 10% off your total expenditure. So enjoy, and enjoy the benefit on An Hour of Gold. Let's get back to why I got pulled off my game. It happens, you know, to all of us periodically. We get pulled off our game. We have what we call good days and bad days, or we go through periods when things just aren't seem to working for us. And I can only share with you what I know is true for me, and you can decide whether or not it's true for you. So I'm going to give you my experience of what happens when I get pulled off my game and why. I practiced law for 13 years, and I became an attorney because it was a great profession, I thought. It was a respected profession at a point in time in history. It was a money-generating, an income-generating profession. It had a future. Women were moving into it in the greatest numbers they had ever moved into. I was the first person in my family to complete college, although my sister had gone, she hadn't completed. And it was something that I could be proud of, my family could be proud of, and I saw a future there, and I had the ability to do it. I never really asked myself if it was my passion, if it was who I really was, because I was very busy trying to fit into society in the acceptable ways. So the things that I was really good at, which were inspiration, intuition, passion, I couldn't find a degree anywhere. Nobody wanted to give me a degree in any of those. And so if they weren't going to give me a degree, they certainly weren't going to give me a job. And if they weren't going to give me a job, they weren't going to pay me anything. So there didn't seem to be a good practical reason to become an inspirationalist or an intuitive or I don't even know what you call someone who's just plain passionate, but a passionista, I guess. We'll go with passionista. I didn't see a reason to do any of those things, and I didn't have any societal support to do any of those things. So off I went into law. And while I love the law, because it was, you know, mentally I love the stimulation and I love the challenge, and I had a great respect for the purity of the law. And unfortunately, I was very good at the law. So it kept me for 13 years. It held me for 13 years. And I don't regret those years because I helped a lot of people and I know that. But I wasn't in love with what I was doing. It wasn't a passion of mine. And I remember my father, may he rest in peace, always used to say that in all his life, he never got up and went to work in his entire life. And my father was a millionaire, but he said he never got up and went to work because he got up every day and he did what he loved. And so he never thought he went to work. He always got up and went to love. And I didn't have that feeling. I liked law. It was challenging. And I was helping people, which was a good thing, and I was making great money, which was an even better thing. But I didn't love what I did, and I wanted to love. I wanted that feeling. So after 13 years, I left law, but I still didn't know what I wanted to do. And yet I knew I still was drawn to those qualities that were in me, which was inspiration and passion and intuition. And I tried several things over several years. And eventually, I remembered how much I loved motivating my clients when I practiced law, and how much I loved the writing piece, the creative writing piece of writing a closing if I was trying a case, or making my argument in an opening argument, or just negotiating with the other side and adamantly and passionately arguing for my client's interest and what their issues were. And I remembered how much I loved being on the radio, because I had a radio show in Pennsylvania called Higher Ground, where I talked about the highest possible message in all of the news of the day. But I stuck to the news pretty much. But I loved I loved being on the radio. I loved sharing with people. I loved engaging in my mind what you were doing out there while you were listening to me, and how you were being inspired or maybe just motivated by what I was saying. And so I put it all together, and it took me a while. But what I finally came to was, I wrote a book recently called The Lightworker's Handbook, A Spiritual Guide to Eliminating Fear, because that's always been my thing, moving into what frightened me, moving into the things that I found difficult, causing myself to push myself past my comfort level, to think outside the box and act outside the box in addition to thinking that way. So I wrote a book about it. And by the way, the book is at my website, www.carolwithanegold.com, or Barnes & Noble or Amazon, The Lightworker's Handbook, A Spiritual Guide to Eliminating Fear. I wrote the book. I'm back on the radio. I write an inspirational blog 5 days a week at my website. I speak to groups, individuals, corporations. I'm a personal change agent. I work with people individually to inspire them and move them past where they are at this moment in their lives. And so I've come to where I'm living all of those innate abilities that I was gifted that society said have no value. And all of a sudden, they're bringing me value. Not only are they bringing value to my life in terms of the quality of my life, but they're bringing dollars in the door. So I'm now doing what I love every day, every minute of the day. I'm doing what I love. Except last week, I got thrown off my game. Because when I prepared for the show, I started to think about how I better cover some of these hot issues that are happening in the news. And I was listening to the other talk show hosts around the country, and they were all pretty much on the same few subjects. And it was breaking news. After all, you know, we had gotten this incredible evil human being who had been on the planet for however long, and it was a great moment. And people were saying all kinds of things about that. And I thought, well, I better cover that too. And the next thing I knew, I had a worthless half hour of radio. For me and for you. And that didn't feel good, and I didn't like that feeling. And I don't think that you need me for that kind of disingenuousness. You need me for authenticity, because the world is full of deception. And what we need to find in ourselves and others is the truth of it all. And the truth starts with living your own personal truth. So if there's a message that I can share with you from last week, it's that you too were born with unique gifts. You too were born with special talent. And while your immediate environment or the culture or the society may not have told you it was okay to actualize your unique gifts, that somehow they weren't valuable, or you were, you know, the odd person out because you didn't get it the way everybody else got it. Nothing could be further from the truth. You know, when I look at nature, I always find all the answers I need for everything that I'm looking for. And when I look outside and I plant in my backyard tulips for spring, and spring comes, and I walk over to where I planted those tulips, daisies don't come up. Tulips come up. And that's because tulips don't have free will. They know what they are. It's programmed into their DNA. And no matter how much adversity they come up against, now how many rocks, how many worms, how many cat and dog accidents, no matter what they come up against, they push through with enough sunlight and water, and they become who they were meant to be. We have that little tricky thing called free will, and we get to choose all the time. And sometimes we choose things that are not in our highest good. And those choices are sometimes dictated by external pressures, whether it's family, friends, relatives, society, culture, religion, whatever it is. We get these external pressures that help us, and I put the help in quotes, help us make choices about what's in our best interest. And what I can tell you here at An Hour of Gold, what I know with certainty is that no one can know how to live your life better than you do, because everything you need to know to live the best life you're capable of as an individual, with all the special gifts you were born with, are programmed right inside of you. They're in your DNA like that tulip. In your DNA is everything you're meant to be in your life. But the trick is to learn how to go within and access the information internally and not be externally motivated. The place to be externally motivated is with compassion. You want to take compassion and use it with all the other human beings on the planet. You see, the first and foremost law of the universe is do no harm. And almost every major religion has some version of that concept. And the reason is because it's the primal principle by which we should be living. In Judaism, because I am a Jew, in Judaism it's do not do unto another that which you would not have done unto you. It's that simple. So when you want to connect to the world, when you want to take your individuality and you want to bring it to the world, understand that we're all connected. And when you understand that we're all connected, compassion becomes your highest guiding principle, because you wouldn't want to do to someone else what you wouldn't want done to yourself. And if you understand that that other is you, that there's only one of us, then you understand that every harm you cause, you don't just cause to another, you cause to yourself as well, because we are all connected. And while some people may think of it in terms of, well, you know, everybody gets theirs, or every dog has their day, or everything comes back to you, those are sort of a negative way of looking at a very beautiful principle, which is that we're all connected, and that as we elevate ourselves, we elevate all of humanity. And as we degrade ourselves or dishonor ourselves, or in my case, are inauthentic with ourselves, we do harm. We do no good. Because as I said at the outset of this part of the show, you didn't need to tune into me last week to hear the same thing you could have heard on 100 other stations or analyzed similarly elsewhere. You needed to tune into me to hear something special. And the something special that I didn't tell you last week was that whether Osama bin Laden is alive or dead, it doesn't really matter to who you choose to be when you get up each morning. So I'm going to take a break and let you chew on some of that. And you can feel free, give me a call in the next half hour, 856-227-1360. I am very interested in how you're living an authentic life, or times when you get tripped up, as we all do. I share everything I experience, and I'm open to sharing yours. Be right back. Welcome back here to An Hour of Gold. This is Carol Gold. You're listening to WNJC 1360 AM. A little housekeeping before I get back to my subject matter. First of all, I'm speaking this Thursday evening at the Adelphia Restaurant in Deptford at 7 p.m. I'm speaking through an organization called Powerful You. Please feel free, and I welcome you to stop by and spend some time with me that evening. I'll be signing my newly released book, The Lightworker's Handbook, A Spiritual Guide to Eliminating Fear, which you can also pick up at Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, or directly and probably fastest off my website, Carol, C-A-R-O-L-E, Carol with an E, gold.com. Right before the break, I was talking about, I happened to mention Osama bin Laden, and I mentioned why I had sort of gotten off track and covered that story last week in a way that I wasn't comfortable. But I do want to take a minute here and address some things that do relate to his death, because they are definitely related to what I do here at An Hour of Gold. What I noticed stunningly after the assassination, or whatever you call it, I guess everybody's got a different name for whether we murdered him or we wrongfully killed him or we assassinated him or we just, you know, took him out, whatever the phrase is that works for you, I was aware of the photographs that were being shown, the visual picture images of him on the internet and television, and how they were distinguished in my mind from the images they showed while he was still alive. And this is what I mean. When they went into the compound and they found the absolute squalor that he was living in and what he looked like, the images that have come out since are of a rather... He's disheveled looking. He looks filthy. The images that are from the compound, the compound looks filthy. He looks very undesirable, for lack of any other word. And yet, I remember how before he was killed, whenever I saw images of him, in most instances, he looked like something out of Lawrence of Arabia, if you remember the movie. He was always in this white turban wrap thing and this long white robe, and he looked quite swashbuckling, for lack of a better word. He looked like a hero out of an Arabic saga. And I thought about how manipulated we really are by the way we get the news and the visual images that are attached to it. Because in an instant, overnight, the media went from being sort of enchanted with the romantic, mystical part of this very bad guy to portraying him as some slum-living, you know, strange person who had very little self-respect, apparently. Because who lives like that unless you have little self-respect? And who grabs one of their wives to shield themselves from being shot? Except someone whose values you would never want to espouse and not someone you would see as an admirable leader. So my point is this. It's not about Osama bin Laden. It's about reality. Be very careful. Be very careful of where you get your news and be very careful of what images you look at. Because we are easily manipulated by both the written word and the visuals that come along with it to walk around with a certain impression. And I really believe that the mystique of Osama bin Laden, separate from his own need to hide or his own desire to hide, the mystique that we gave him by portraying him in the media as something somewhat glamorous in a perverse way did no good and served no one. And it certainly didn't serve you. And now we see him for who he really was and what evil looks like. I mean, isn't it the New Testament that says cleanliness is next to godliness? Well, he's living proof of where he is now because he lived in squalor. And it says something about him, and it should say something to people all around the world about his real mentality, which then creates a more total picture of who he really was. But we didn't get that because we were conditioned by the news as we got it. And this is what always happens. This is what happens in every story, be it the written word or the visual. You want to be very selective about where you get the news and what you look at. You know, I know that when they said they were going to release the pictures of his dead body before they decided not to, I had made a commitment not to look at those pictures. And I remember last week on the show, I had told you as well, I suggested that you not look at them either if they were released, because there could be no good in looking at that picture. Just as I heard this morning, they're about to release pictures of Diana, Princess Diana, on Friday. There's going to be a huge, like an opening of a film at Cannes, I believe it's being shown. On the beaches at Cannes, they have this huge theater set up outside. And a documentary has been done on her. And for the first time, they are about to release images of her in the Mercedes right before she died. It's appalling. Not only is it cruel and insensitive to her children, regardless of what you think about the sanity of the royal family, not only is it cruel to her children, it's pointless, it's meaningless, it serves no good, and all it does is distress us, and it speaks to our lowest common denominator, which is to somehow take some perverse pleasure in suffering. And so, again, it's a caution about where and how you get your news. Probably the best place you can go for information is within. That's what I always say. Because you need everything you need to know to live your life is within you. You really don't, in a sense, need the news. I mean, you need the news the way you need fear. You need fear because if you're being chased by a lion or a tiger or a terrorist, you need to get out of the way. And basically, you need news if something is happening that directly affects you, that is pertinent to the day you're living your life in which you're getting the news. Short of that, most news is either old news or news that's happening somewhere else that has absolutely no bearing on you. So in a sense, local news is the best news. Although, you know, I'm not saying only listen to local news. I'm just saying be aware. Be very aware of the manipulation through images and through the written word. The other thing about his death is that my initial reaction was like everyone else's. Thank God he's dead. Glad that he's gone. Goodbye to bad rubbish, as they say, or as my grandmother used to say. But then my second reaction was more circumspect. My second reaction was, are we allowed to rejoice at anyone's death? And while I know there have been talk shows that have spoken to this, I want to talk about it with just a little bit of a twist. In the Torah, in the first five books of Moses in the Old Testament, or in the Talmud, I'm not sure where it's from, there is a commentary that at the Reed Sea, which is commonly known as the Red Sea, when the Red Sea, and that was a translation error, by the way, it's the Reed Sea, but when the Red Sea was parted and the Israelites had crossed, and then the Egyptians were crossing, and they were all swallowed up in the water, and the Israelites were dancing and rejoicing on the other side of the sea, God said, "Why are you rejoicing? My children are drowning." And the admonition and the lesson of that analysis is that even Pharaoh and the Egyptians are God's children. And so why were the Israelites rejoicing if God's children were dying? And it was that teaching that I had many years ago that caused me to take a second look at his death. Not so much at his death, but at our rejoicing of his death. Because on a spiritual level, it was probably a no-no to rejoice at his death. I'm not saying the world is not better off with that energy no longer present, but we have to be very careful. And the careful that I'm talking about is, as a lawyer, I very much know how to look at the facts and live in the reality that we live in. But as a mystic, which I also am, I spend a lot of my time in the metaphysical world. But because we live in a holographic reality, because things are not black and white, up or down, left or right, us or them, because they are that Nagarjuna tetralemma, four choice, more gray area that I spoke of in the first half hour of the show, there is a point in the matrix. There is a point in the hologram. There is a point in the wholeness of creation where physics and metaphysics intersect, where the reality and the spirituality intersect, and they intersect in us. They intersect in humanity. They intersect in the fact that we live in a physical world, but we are made up of a spiritual soul. And so it's not wrong to both be happy that the energy that Osama bin Laden carried is removed from the planet. It's also not wrong at the same time to say maybe we shouldn't rejoice in the killing of him. Because does the killing of him make us any better? We know that it dispersed the energy that was him. However, we also know others can take his place. So the real question becomes about us. Are we better for having done it? I don't know. I'm not going to judge that. I'm only saying it's open for conversation. I'm saying that it's open for discussion. I'm saying, most importantly, that to have the discussion is not shameful. It doesn't make you a fool for not being happy that he's dead. And it doesn't make you any more enlightened that you do think that you are glad he's dead. It's not a matter of that. It's a matter of, it's not black and white. It's not black and white. And if we think it's black and white, then here's what happens. Then you only tune into a talk show depending on what you believe. So if you think it's black and white and it's good that he's dead and it's great that we killed him and we should go out and kill more of these terrorists and let these SEALs rip, let them go, you know, and let's knock off everybody who's our enemy, then you want to tune into shows that's where they're coming from. And if you think death is always shameful and you should never kill anything, and there's beauty in everyone, including Hitler and Osama bin Laden, then you should be tuning into a spiritual show that is the perspective. But here's the problem. You've got to choose one or the other, unless there's a place where we can meet and have the discussion and say maybe both are true. You know, it's the third lemma, X and not X. Maybe they're both true. Maybe there's some truth in both of those. Maybe the world is a better place that he's gone, and maybe we shouldn't rejoice that he's dead. And then that makes us bigger people, and that makes us open up our vision for the world, and it lets us understand things with a broader perspective. And I think that that's where we're headed. And if it's not, it's where we need to be headed, because a black and white world hasn't gotten us as far as we want to go, and it's very limiting. It's very limiting because that's how you get Republicans or Democrats. And one is either right or the other is right. And in between, there is no happy middle ground. There's only inauthentic compromise where nobody gets what they want. You know, when I practiced law, I remember the master who sits in place of a judge to hear divorce cases in Pennsylvania. When we would get in front of a master, one of the masters, a woman, she used to always say to the couple who was about to go through a hearing, listen, today is the last day before this hearing starts that you two can each have control of your own futures. After today, I get to control your future. So if you want to have any say over what happens in the rest of your life, make sure that you do it today, because once this trial starts, once this hearing starts, I'm in charge of what happens to you, you're not. And so it becomes a very black and white issue for people. You know, it's me against the other side. That's what law is. It's an adversarial system. It's black and white. And it doesn't allow us to become our higher selves, which is why when I left law for a brief period of time, I became a mediator. Because mediation is somewhat of that middle ground where you want to take the conflict out of it and help the people find middle ground. But here's the point I started to make. The guiding principle in most courtrooms, especially in family law, is let's give them each something so they both go away happy and they both go away miserable. That's how most judges approach resolving divorce cases. They try to figure out, they try to give a little bit to each side so that both go away feeling they got something, but both go away also feeling they didn't get something. And when they do the math and they weigh the numbers and they look at the possibilities, both of them decide not to take an appeal. Because they're at least they have what they have, and if they shoot for more, maybe they'll get less. However, I've been in courtrooms when clearly one party had done something to the other that needed to be consequenced, that there needed to be not a resolution that gave everybody something, but let the one person know that what they had done was harmful and a violation of the law, which is what the law is there to do. It's there to delineate legal from illegal behavior. Harmful behavior from behavior that does not cause harm. And so what happens in a black and white world is, even if you get compromise, compromise just means everybody went away unhappy. That's what compromise means. But when you don't see the other as your enemy, when you look for common goals, even when you're in an adversarial situation, when you realize that ultimately what you want is your own happiness and the happiness of that other person, because that other person is you, because there's only one of us and we're all connected, then there become more possible resolutions, because the playing field enlarges. And instead of it's me or him, it's me or her, it's me or the other, instead of I have to win and they have to lose, it becomes what are the possibilities so everyone can win? And everyone wins when the solution moves toward the highest good for all concerned. When you keep in mind that you are connected to that other, in a way that cannot be breached, in a way that cannot be broken, that we are all connected to one another in a way that is our very existence, because out of the other you arise. Without the other, you don't have an existence. Everything is relational. Everything is relative. We all get our identities, in a sense, off of other people, the way you don't know light without dark, the way you don't know up without down. But they're not opposites. Light and dark are not opposites. Up and down are not opposites. They are polar extremes of the same frequency. They are just the end poles. They're not opposites. They are on a continuum. They are on a continuum. They are a gradation from one to the other and back again. And you cannot know one without the other. You cannot know yourself without the other, whoever the other is. We define ourselves in relationship to other people, how we treat them, how we see them, how we interact with them. So every action that we take is a self-definition. It's an action of who I am. No matter how I treat you, I'm saying so much more about myself than I could possibly be saying about you. And that's what we have to remember about our connectedness and our wholeness. And that if we come from a place of authenticity within ourselves, we're more likely to become who it is we really are, as opposed to who it is we think we should be or who it is we think we will fit in best as. That's still running around in a costume. You know, it might as well be Halloween, because it's not you, it's somebody else. I heard a remarkable story this week. I read a remarkable story. I watched a remarkable story of this very principle that I'm talking about, being who you really are. I went in search on the internet of positive news. And I was shocked at how many websites there really are where you can get positive news. And I read the story of a man named John Francis. John Francis, in 1971, John Francis is an African-American who in 1971 was living in San Francisco. And at the time, there was an oil spill, a major oil spill. I don't think it was the Exxon Valdez. That was later. I think it was an oil spill in San Francisco Bay, actually, for some reason. I may be wrong, but the important part is John Francis. He was actually a Philadelphian. He was born here in 1946, I think. And as a result of that oil spill, he was so shocked by the damage that it did that he made up his mind that he was not going to ride in or use any vehicle that required fuel. So he began to walk everywhere. Everywhere. He refused to use anything motorized. And he walked to Oregon. He walked to Washington State. He walked everywhere. And in fact, during that year when he was walking everywhere, he started to realize that when other people spoke to him, he didn't really listen. He only listened to the first few words or sentences till he had the gist of what they were going to say. And then he shut them off and he would begin to prepare what he was going to answer back. And when he realized he was doing that, he decided not to talk for a day to see what that was like. So he didn't. He didn't talk for a day. And then he realized just how much he was missing when he spoke. So he decided not to talk for a week. And then he decided not to talk for a year. And then he didn't talk for 17 years. And he walked and he didn't talk for 17 years. He walked across the United States. He went to two universities without speaking. He got into two universities without speaking. He taught at, I think, the University of Wisconsin and never spoke. He got a PhD in environmentalism without speaking. And he taught a course in environmentalism without speaking. If you doubt any of what I'm saying, look up John Francis on the internet. He's written two books, and I'm going to tell you what they are, but I want to make a point about why I'm bringing all this up. He wrote two books, one called Planet Walker, How to Change Your World One Step at a Time. And most recently, he wrote a book called The Ragged Edge of Silence. He worked for the U.S. Coast Guard, and he became a United Nations Environmental Program Goodwill Ambassador and walked all the way. Well, he didn't walk all the way. He walked to South America, but he took sailboats where he couldn't walk because he wouldn't use a motorized vehicle. And it was when he got to Venezuela that he realized that he had things to do that he could only do if he spoke. And so after 17 years, he came back to the United States, and he now lectures and has written these books and speaks about the books that he's written. But here's the point. He said in his wildest dreams, he couldn't believe that he could work for the U.S. Coast Guard, doing very highly specialized work, teach at a university, and become an environmental goodwill ambassador, having not spoken and having walked everywhere. So here is a person who went within, and in going within, accomplished success in our society beyond his wildest dreams, beyond anyone's wildest dreams, because he was authentic. He went inside and he came from his authentic self. His authentic self said, I'm so appalled by the oil spill, I'm not using fuel. And then his authentic self said, you don't listen very well, so he got quiet. And as a result, he is an honorable human being who is a terrific role model, who we can look up to, who we can learn from, and who teaches the highest lesson, which is that when you go inside, access your own DNA, those seeds that are in you, those seeds that are in me, that were planted at the time of our conception, that hold the information for who you are meant to be, fully blossomed, fully grown, fully who you are meant to be in this world. When you go there in search of that information is revealed to you. But when you look only external to yourself to find those answers, all you find are answers that other people have. And those answers aren't yours because you're a tulip and they're a daisy. It's what I remembered last week when I got off my game. And it's what I hope you carry with you in the coming week as you make your best effort to stay on your game. I'd like to remind you that I'm speaking this Thursday night at the Adelphia in Deptford at 7 p.m. And the organization is called A Powerful You. Anyone is welcome. Please join me. I'll be author signing my new book, A Lightworker's Handbook, a Spiritual Guide to Eliminating Fear, which is a wonderful reminder of how to stay on your game. And in the back of the book is what I call my English to Spirit Dictionary, which is a lot of terms redefined for the 21st century so we can elevate the discourse and have a more enlightened conversation like we do here every Tuesday morning on An Hour of Gold on WNJC 1360 AM. Please also visit my website, carolwithanegold.com, where you can check out my inspirational CDs, order my book, read my inspirational blog, or any of the other ways that I'm here to support you in your highest good. I'll leave you with two thoughts. If you're not feeling well, if you're having a bad day, or if anything happens to you during the week that causes you any pain or suffering, please remember that the only healing is a return to love. There's only one of us. See you next week on An Hour of Gold.
WNJC, 1360 AM, Washington Township,
Philadelphia.
Philadelphia's Renaissance Radio Station, broadcasting online at WNJC1360.com, a service of Forsyth Broadcasting.